Chapter 11. The next day, after drills and studies, I make it back out to the orchard. It's a warm day, and I dodge from the shade of one tree to another as I stroll. I walk over mushy, sweet-stinking apples, feeling them turn to goop beneath my feet. Despite the heat of the sun, the air is crisp and pleasant today, not too hot or cold. I feel weirdly happy and hopeful as I tramp around. Katerina is booking us plane tickets to Australia today. She thinks it'll make as good a hiding place as any. I'm already excited for the journey. I turn, ready to walk back to the motel, when a soccer ball comes rolling past me, scudding over broken apples. Without thinking, I leap forward and hop on it with one foot, stopping it in its tracks. "You gonna give that back or what?" Startled, I turn around. A pretty girl with a chestnut ponytail stares at me from the edge of the orchard. She's dressed in soccer clothes, and her mouth is open, smacking on bubblegum. I step off the ball, pivot around it, and give it a quick kick right to the girl. I use more strength than I should. When she clutches it with her hands, the force of the impact nearly sends her off her feet. "Easy!" she yells. "Sorry," I say, instantly ashamed. "Good kick, though," says the girl, sizing me up. "Damn good kick." I am on the field moments later. The girl's team was short a player for scrimmage, and the gum-chewing girl, Tyra, somehow convinced the coach to let me play. I don't know the rules of soccer, but I pick them up soon enough. I owe Katerina for that, for keeping my brain sharp enough to process rules quickly. The coach, a dour, squat lady with a whistle in her mouth, puts me in as a fullback, and I quickly establish myself as a force. The girls on my team catch on fast, and soon enough they're putting up a wall, forcing the other team's forwards to run past me on the right side of the field. Not one of them gets through without losing their hold on the ball. Before I know it, I'm covered in sweat, blades of grass sticking to the sweat on my calves. Fortunately, I wore high socks today, so no one can see my scars. I'm dizzy and happy from the sun and the appreciative cheers of my teammates. There's a reversal to my left. Tyra's seized the ball from a charging opponent before getting chased by another member of the opposing team. I'm the only free player, and she manages to kick the ball right at me. Suddenly, almost the entire opposing team is on my tail. My teammates chase after them, trying to keep them away from me as I make a mad dash with the ball towards the goal. I can see the goalie steeling herself, ready for my approach. My opponents break free of my blocking teammates. Even though I am still nearly half the field from the box, I know it's my only chance. I kick. The ball swings in a long, curving arc, propelled like a jet. I acted too fast, too thoughtlessly, and have aimed right at the goalie's position. I'm sure she'll catch it. She does. But I've kicked the ball with such power that it lifts her off her feet, and the ball goes out of her hands, spinning against the net behind her. My teammates cheer. Our opponents join in. This was only a scrimmage, so they can acknowledge my skills without sacrificing too much pride. Tyra gives me a pat on the shoulder. I can tell she's excited about having been the one to coax me out of the orchard. The coach pulls me aside and asks where I go to school. She clearly wants me for her team. "Not from here," I mumble. "Sorry." She shrugs and congratulates me on my playing. I grin and walk away from the field. I can tell the girls are eager for my friendship, standing in a cluster and watching me depart. I imagine a different life for myself. A life like theirs. It has its charms, but I know my place is by Katerina's side. I walk back to the motel, doing my best to wipe the grin of victory off my face. I feel a childish urge to blab about the game to Katerina, even though she told me not to play. In spite of myself, I find I'm running back to the room, ready to start crowing. The door's unlocked and I swing it open, still grinning like an idiot. The grin doesn't last long. There are 10 men in the room. Mogadorians. Katerina is tied to the motel's desk chair, her mouth gagged and her forehead bloody, her eyes filling with tears at the sight of me. I turn to run, but then I see them. More men, some in cars, some just standing there, all over the parking lot. There must be 30 Mogadorians total. We've been caught. Chapter 12. My hands are cuffed, and my legs are bound in rope. Katerina's are too, though I can't see her. The Mogadorians threw us in the back of a big rig's trailer, tied together, so the only proof of Katerina I have is the place where our spines touch. The trailer bucks wildly, and I know we are on the highway, going somewhere fast. Katerina is still gagged, but they never bothered to gag me. Either they sensed I would stay quiet to keep Katerina safe, or they figured the roar of the road would swallow any sound I made. I don't have any idea where we're being taken, or what the Mogadorians plan to do to us once we get there. I assume the worst, but I still murmur soft, soothing things to Katerina in the dark of the trailer. I know she'd be doing the same thing for me if she could. "It'll be okay," I say. "We'll be okay." I know we won't. I know with sick certainty that this journey will end in our deaths. Katerina presses her back against mine in a gesture of love and encouragement. Hands tied and mouth gagged, it's the only way she can communicate with me. It's dark in the trailer, save for a small sliver of light shining through a break in the trailer's aluminum roof. Sunlight dribbles in through the crack. Sitting in the dark, musty chill of the trailer, it is strange to think it's day outside. Ordinary day. I'm achy everywhere, sore from sitting, and too uncomfortable to sleep. In my exhausted delirium, I have the ridiculous thought that I should have stayed behind with the soccer girls, at least long enough to have some of the Gatorade the coach offered me. Something murmurs inside the trailer, a low, guttural growl. There is a cage, tucked up against the front of the trailer. I can dimly make out its thick steel bars in the dark. "What is it?" I ask. Katerina mumbles through her gagged mouth, and I feel bad for asking her a question she can't possibly answer. I lean forward, as far as I can, pulling Katerina with me. I can hear Katerina protest from beneath her gag, but curiosity pushes me forward. I stretch into the darkness, bringing my face as close to the steel bars as I can. Another rustle in the dark. Another captive, I wonder? Some kind of beast? My heart fills with pity. "Hello?" I speak into the void. The person or creature makes low whimpers of distress. "Are you okay?" Jaws snap with sudden force against the bars of the cage, eyes the size of fists flashing red in the dark. The breath of the beast sends my hair back. I pull away in terror and disgust, the smell so revolting I almost retch. I try to scoot away, But the huge beast, unappeased, keeps its head pressed to the bars, its red eyes fixed on me. I know that were it not for the bars, I'd be dead already. This is no captive, no fallen ally. This is a piken. Katerina told me about these beasts before, savage accomplices and hunters for the Mogadorians, but I had taken them for fairy tales. Katerina helps me nudge us back towards the rear, giving me more space to pull away from the beast. As I back farther away, so does the piken, disappearing into the dark of its cage. I know I am safe for the moment, but I also know this animal, this foul, fearsome creature, may be pitted against me in the coming days or weeks. My stomach turns in fear and helpless rage. I don't know whether to vomit or pass out or both. I nestle my damp head against Katerina's, wishing this nightmare away. I fall into an agitated half-sleep, awoken only by Katerina's voice. Six. Wake up. Six. I snap to. Your gag? I ask. I worked it off. It's taken this whole time to get it off. Oh, I say stupidly. I don't know what else to say, what good it does us to speak. We are caught without defense. They bugged our car, back in Texas. That's how they found us. How stupid of us, I think. How careless. It was my job to think of that, she says, as if reading my thoughts. Never mind that. I need you to prepare for what's coming. What's that, I think? Death? They will torture you for information. They will. I hear Katerina succumb to weeping, but she pulls herself together and resumes. They will inflict unthinkable torments on you. But you must bear them. I will, I say, as firmly as I can. They will use me to make you bend. You can't let them. No matter what. My heart freezes in my chest. They will kill Katerina in front of me if they think it will make me talk. Promise me, Six. Please. They can't know your number. We can't give them any more power over the others than they already have, or power over you. The less they know about the charm, the better. Promise me. You have to. Imagining the horrors to come? I can't. I know my vow is all Katerina wants to hear. But I just can't. Chapter 13. I have been in my cell for 3 days. I have nothing in here with me but a bucket of water, another bucket to use as a toilet, and an empty metal tray from yesterday's meal. There is not a speck of food left on the tray. I licked it clean yesterday. When I woke up in my cell 3 days ago, it had been my intention to mount a hunger strike against my captors, to refuse all food and water until they let me see my Katerina. But 2 days passed with no food or water from them anyway. I had begun to imagine I'd been forgotten in my cell. By the time the food arrived, I was so far out of my mind with hopelessness that I forgot my original plan and wolfed down the slop they shoved through the little slot of my cell door. The odd thing is that I wasn't even particularly hungry. My spirits were low, but I didn't feel weak from hunger. My pendant throbbed dully against my chest during my days in the dark, and I began to suspect the charm was keeping me safe from hunger and dehydration. But even though I wasn't starving or dehydrated, I'd never gone so long without food or water in my life, and the experience of being deprived drove me to a kind of temporary madness. I wasn't hungry or thirsty physically, but I was mentally. The walls are made of heavy, rough stone. It feels less like a prison cell and more like a makeshift burrow. It seems to have been carved out of a natural stone formation instead of built. I take this as a clue that we're in some natural structure, a cave or the inside of a mountain. I know I may never find out the answer. I have attempted to chip at the walls of my cell, but even I know there is nothing I can do. In my attempts, all I accomplished was to wear my nails down until the tips of my fingers bled. The only thing left now is to sit in my cell and try to hold on to my sanity. That is my sole mission, to not let my solitary confinement drive me to madness. I can let it harden me. I can let it toughen me. But I must not let it make me crazy. It's a strange challenge, staying sane. If you focus too hard on maintaining your sanity, the slipperiness of the task can only make you crazier. On the other hand, if you forget your mission, if you try to maintain your sanity by not thinking about the matter at all, you can find your mind wandering in such dizzying patterns that you wind up, again, at madness. The trick is to forge a middle ground between the two, a detachment, a state of neutrality. I focus on my breathing. In, out. In, out. When I'm not stretching or doing push-ups in the corner, this is what I do. Just breathe. In, out. In, out. Katerina calls this meditating. She used to try to encourage me to do meditation exercises to keep my focus. She felt it would aid me in combat. I never followed her advice. It seemed too boring. But now that I'm in my cell, I find it is a lifeline, the best way for me to keep my sanity. I am meditating when the door to my cell opens. I turn around, my eyes straining to adjust to the light coming in from the hall. A Moog stands in the light, backed by several others. I see he's holding a bucket, and for a second I imagine he's brought fresh water for me to drink. Instead, he steps forward and empties the bucket over my head, dousing me in cold water. It is a harsh indignity, and I shiver at the cold. But it's also bracing, restorative. It brings me back to life, back to my pure hatred of these bastard Moogs. He lifts me off my feet, dripping wet, and wraps a blindfold around my head. He drops me again, and I struggle to stay upright. "Come," he says, shoving me out of my cell and into the hall. The blindfold is thick, so I am walking in total blackness. But my senses are keen, and I manage a nearly straight line. I can also sense other Moogs all around me. As I walk, my feet cold against the rough stone floors, I hear the varied screams and moans of my fellow prisoners. Some are human, some are animal. They must be locked inside cells like mine. I have no idea who they are or what the Moogs want them for, but I am too focused on my survival right now to care. I am deaf to pity. After a long march, the Moog leading the guard says, "Right," and shoves me to the right. He shoves me hard, and I land on my knees, scraping them against stone. I struggle to get to my feet, but I am picked up before I can, two Moogs throwing me against a wall. My hands are raised and chained to a steel cord dangling from the ceiling. My torso is stretched, my toes just barely touching the ground. They remove my blindfold. I'm in another cell. This one is lit brightly, and my eyes feel like they will burn out adjusting from 3 days of nearly total darkness. Once they do, I see her. Katerina. She is chained to the ceiling, as I am. She looks far worse than me. Bloody, bruised, and beaten. They started with her.
Katerina,
I whisper.
Are you okay?
She looks up at me, her eyes brimming with tears.
Don't look at me, she says, her eyes drifting down to the floor.
A new Moog enters the room. He is wearing, of all things, a white polo shirt and a crisp pair of khaki pants. His haircut is short. His shoes, loafers, scuff quietly across the floor. He could be a suburban dad or the manager of a neighborhood store.
Howdy, he says.
He grins at me, his hands in his pocket. His teeth are white like in a toothpaste commercial.
Hope you're enjoying your stay with us so far.
I notice the bristly hair on his tan arms. He is handsome in a bland way, with a compact but strong-looking build.
These caves can be awfully drafty, but we try to make it as cozy as possible. I trust you have 2 buckets in your cell. Wouldn't want you to go without.
His hand reaches out so casually that for a second I think he is going to caress my cheek. Instead, he pinches it hard, giving my flesh a twist.
You are our guests of honor, after all, he says, the venom at last creeping into his salesman's voice.
I hate myself for doing it, but I begin to cry. My legs give out entirely, and I dangle hard against my cuffs. I don't allow myself to sob audibly, though. He can see me cry, but I won't let him hear it.
Okay, ladies, he says, clapping his hands together and approaching a little desk tucked into the corner of the cell.
He opens a drawer and pulls out a vinyl case, which he unwraps on the surface of the desk. The ceiling light glints off an array of sharp steel objects. He picks them up, one at a time, so I can see them all. Scalpels, razors, pliers, blades of every kind, a pocket-size electric drill. He gives it a few nerve-shattering whirs before putting it down. He strides over to me, putting his face right up in mine. He speaks, and his breath forces its way into my nostrils. I want to retch.
Do you see all of these?
I don't respond. His breath smells like the breath of the beast in the cage. Despite his bland exterior, he's made of the same foul stuff.
I intend to use each and every one of them on you and your Sepan, unless you answer every question I ask truthfully. If you don't, I assure you that both of you will wish you were dead.
He gives a hateful little grin and walks back over to the desk, picking up a thin-looking razor blade with a thick rubber handle. He returns to me, rubbing the dull side of the blade against my cheek.
It's cold. I've been hunting you kids for a very long time, he says. We've killed 2 of you, and now we have one right here. Whatever number you are, as you might imagine, I hope you are number 3.
I try to inch away from him, pressing my back hard against the cell wall, wishing I could disappear into the stone.
He smiles at me again, pressing the dull side of the razor into my cheek. Harder this time.
Oops, he says tauntingly. That's not the right side.
With a single dexterous motion, he reverses the blade in his wrist, the sharp side now facing me.
Let's try it this way, shall we?
With reptilian pleasure, he brings the blade to the side of my face and swipes hard against my flesh. I feel a familiar warmth, but no pain, and watch with shock as his own cheek begins to bleed instead. Blood flows from his wound as it splits open like a seam. He drops the blade, clutching his face, and begins stamping around the room in pain and frustration. He kicks over the desk, sending his instruments of torture scattering across the cell, then flees the room. The Moog guards who'd been standing behind him exchange indecipherable glances. Before I even have a chance to say anything to Katerina, the Moogs move forward, unshackle me, and drag me back to my cell. Chapter 14. 2 days pass. In the dark of my cell, I now have more than madness and boredom to contend with. I must also work to burn the image of a bloody and broken Katerina from my mind. I want to remember Katerina as I know her, wise and strong. I continue with my breathing exercises. They help, but not much. Eventually, the cell door opens, and again I'm doused with cold water, gagged this time, blindfolded, and dragged back to the same cell. Once I've been chained to the ceiling, my blindfold is removed. Katerina is right where I last saw her, as broken and battered as before. I can only hope she's been let down at some point. The same Moog as before sits across from us, on the edge of the desk, a bandage across his sliced cheek. I can see he is straining to be as menacing as he was before, but he regards us with a new fear. I hate him, more than anyone I have ever met. If I could tear him apart with my bare hands, I would. If I couldn't use my hands, I would rip him apart with my teeth. He sees me looking at him. He leaps forward suddenly, tearing the gag from my mouth. He wields the rubber-handled razor in front of my face again, twisting it, letting the ceiling light dance across its edge. I don't know what number you are, he says. I cringe involuntarily, expecting him to try and cut me again, but he holds back. Then, with sadistic deliberateness, he crosses over to Katerina, pulling on her hair. Still gagged, she manages only a whimper. But you're going to tell me right now.
No!
I scream. He grins with satisfaction at my anguish, like he's been waiting for it. He presses the blade to Katerina's arm and slides it down her flesh. Her arm opens up, pouring blood. She buckles against her chains, tears flooding her face. I try to scream, but my voice gives out. All that comes out is a high, pained gasp. He makes another cut beside the first, this one even deeper. Katerina succumbs to the pain and goes limp. With my teeth, I think. I can do this all day, he says. Do you understand me? You're going to tell me everything I want to know, starting with what number you are. I close my eyes. My heart burns. I feel like a volcano, only there's no opening, no outlet for the rage filling up inside of me. When I open my eyes, he's back at the desk, tossing a large blade from his left hand to his right hand and back, playfully, waiting for my gaze. Now that he's got it, he holds the blade up so I can see its size. It begins to glow in his hands, changing colors, violet one second, green the next.
Now, your number. 4, 7. Are you lucky enough to be number 9?
Katerina, barely conscious, shakes her head. I know she's signaling me to keep silent. She has kept her silence this long. I struggle to keep quiet, but I can't handle it. Can't watch him hurt my Katerina, my Sepan. He walks over to Katerina, still wielding the blade. Katerina murmurs something beneath her gag. Curious, he lowers it from her mouth. She spits a thick wad of blood onto the floor by his feet.
Torturing me to get to her.
He eyes her hatefully, impatient.
Yes, that's about right.
Katerina manages a scornful, slow-building laugh.
It took you 2 whole days to come up with that plan.
I can see his cheeks turn red at the well-aimed jab. Even Mogadorians have their pride.
You must be some kind of idiot, she howls.
I thrill at Katerina's impudence, proud of her defiance, but afraid of what the consequence will be.
I have all the time in the galaxies for this, he says flatly. While you are in here with me, we are out there with the rest of you. Don't think anything has stopped us from moving forward just because we have you. We know more than you think, but we want to know everything.
He cruelly strikes Katerina with the butt of the knife before she can speak again. He turns to me.
If you don't want to see her sliced into little pieces, then you better start talking, and fast. And every single word that comes out better be true. I will know if you're lying.
I know he isn't playing games, and I can't bear to see him hurt Katerina again. If I talk, maybe he'll be merciful. Maybe he'll leave her alone. It comes out so fast, I barely have time to order my thoughts. So fast, I barely know what I'm saying when I say it. I have one intention, but it's a murky one. To tell him everything I know that he can't use against me or the other Lorians. I tell him pointless details about my previous journeys with Katerina, our previous identities. I tell him about my chest, but I don't give its burial location, claiming it was lost in our journey. Once I start talking, I'm afraid to stop. I know that if I pause to measure my words, he will smell my deceit. Then he asks me what number I am. I know what he wants to hear. That I am number 4. I can't be 3, or else they would have been able to kill me. But if I'm 4, then all he'll need is to find and kill 3 before he can begin his bloody work on me.
I am number 8,
I say finally. I am so scared, I say it with a desperate, cringing sigh, that I know that he's fooled. His face falls.
Sorry to disappoint you,
I croak out. His disappointment is short-lived. He begins to beam, victorious. I may not be the number he wanted, but he got my number out of me. Or what he thinks is my number. I search out Katerina's eyes, and though she is barely conscious, I can see the faintest hint of gratitude in her eyes. She is proud of me for giving him the wrong number.
You really are weak, aren't you?
He stares at me with contempt. Let him, I think. I feel a surge of superiority over him. He was dumb enough to believe my lie.
Your relatives on Lorien. As easy as they fell, at least they were fighters. At least they had some bravery and dignity. But you...
He shakes his head at me, then spits on the floor.
You have nothing, number eight.
At that, he raises his arm with the blade and thrusts it deep into Katerina. I hear the sound of bone cracking, of the knife pushing through her sternum, right into her heart. I scream. My eyes search out Katerina's. She meets my gaze for one last instant. I will myself past my chains, towards her, struggling to be there for her in her last moment. But her last moment goes fast. My Katerina is dead. Chapter 15. Weeks turn into months. Some days they don't feed me. But my pendant keeps me from dying of thirst or starvation. What's harder is the absence of sunlight, the endless immersion in darkness. Sometimes I lose track of where my body ends and the darkness begins. I lose sense of my own existence, my own borders. I am a cloud of ink in the night, black on black. I feel forgotten, incarcerated with no hope of escape and with no information that can lead them to the others. I am useless to them for now, until they've killed the ones before me, until my extinction date. The urge to survive has gone dormant in me. I live not because I want to, but because I can't die. Sometimes I wish I could. Even so, I force myself to do the work of staying as fit and limber and as ready for combat as I can. Push-ups, sit-ups, games of shadow. In these games of shadow, I have learned to play Katerina's part as well as my own, giving myself instructions, describing my imagined attackers before I respond with my commands. I loved this game before, but now I hate it. Still, in Katerina's honor, I continue to play. As I was lying to the Moog, I thought I was doing it so he would spare Katerina, let her live. But as soon as I saw his knife pierce her heart, I realized what I was really doing, hastening her end. I was giving him everything I knew so he would finish her off, so she wouldn't have to suffer anymore, so I wouldn't have to watch her suffer anymore. I tell myself that was the right thing to do, that it's what Katerina would have wanted. She was in such pain. But I've been without her so long at this point that I would give anything for another moment with her, even if she had to suffer unimaginable torments for it. I want her back. The Mogadorians continue to test the boundaries of my conditional immortality. These trials take time to plan and construct, but every week or so I am dragged out of my cell and brought to another, jury-rigged for my destruction. The first week after Katerina's death, I was brought to a small chamber and made to stand on a sharp steel grill several feet off the floor. The door was sealed behind me. I waited for a few minutes as the room filled with noxious-looking gas curling up from beneath the grill in green tendrils. I covered my mouth, trying not to breathe it, but I could only hold my breath for so long. I gave up, gulping in their poison, only to discover it smelled like the coolest and freshest of mountain breezes to me. Furious Moogs dragged me out of the room minutes later, pushing me quickly back to my cell. But I could see the pile of dust beside the door on the way out. The Moog who had pushed the button releasing the gas had died in my place, The next week, they tried to drown me. The week after, they tried burning me alive. None of these affected me, of course. Last week, they served me food laced so heavily with arsenic, I swear I could taste each poison grain. They had brought a cake to my cell. They had no reason to treat me with dessert, and I knew at once that it was their hope to trick me with the cake, and in turn, trick the charm. They hoped that if I didn't know my life was in danger, the charm wouldn't work. Of course, I suspected them at once. But I ate the cake, anyway. It was delicious. By eavesdropping against the slot of my cell door, I later learned that not one but three Mogadorians perished from the attempted poisoning. How many Mogadorians does it take to bake a cake? I asked myself later. Then, with malevolent satisfaction, I answered. Three. I allow myself to imagine a happy outcome in which the Mogadorians, who seem to place little value even on their own lives, keep trying to kill me and end up dying in the attempt until there are no Mogadorians left. I know it is just a fantasy, but it's a happy one. I have no idea how long I've been here, but I have grown so hardened to their execution attempts that I am fearless as they drag me through the halls to yet another. This time, I am thrown into a large, drafty space with dim lights, larger than any room I've been in so far. I know I am being watched through one-way glass or a video monitor, so I wear my face in a sneer that reads, "Bring it on." Then I hear it, a low, guttural moan. It's so deep I can feel it rattling through the floor. I whirl around to see, deep in the shadows of the room, a large steel cage. It looks familiar. I hear jaws snapping hungrily, followed by the sounds of massive lips smacking. The Piken, the beast from our trip out here. Now, I am scared. There's a bright flash. Suddenly, I'm bathed in strobing red lights, and the steel bars of the cage retract. Weaponless, I fall back against the opposite corner of the room. Clever, I think. The Moogs have never pitted me against a living creature before. The Piken steps out. A four-legged monster, it stands like a bulldog the size of a rhino. Four legs bowed, mouth all dripping, sagging jowls. Massive teeth jut from its mouth like tusks. Its skin is a putrid, knobby green. It smells of death. It roars at me, drenching me in a spittle so thick I fear I will slip on it. Then it charges. I can't believe my own body. I'm stiff from solitary confinement. I haven't practiced combat in months. But instinct and adrenaline kick in, and soon enough I am dodging the beast like a pro, careening off corners, ducking between its legs. The Piken roars, frustrated, getting more and more worked up, battering the walls with its head. I haven't had this much fun in years, I think, as I manage to give it a roundhouse kick across the face. I land on the ground, beaming from my well-placed kick. But I land in one of its spit puddles, and my arms and legs give out in the slime. It's a momentary lapse, but it's enough. The beast has me in its jaws. My whole body floods with warmth, and I am sure that this is the end. But no pain comes. The creature lets out a long whimper and then releases me from its jaws. It's a 5-foot drop from its mouth to the floor, and I land on my knee, which hurts worse than the bite. I turn to see the Piken sprawled out, mouth open, chest heaving powerfully. A massive crescent of puncture wounds stud its chest. It took the brunt of its own bite. It lets out another low, pitiful moan. Of course, I think. A Mogadorian beast is as much a Mogadorian as any of the rest. It's susceptible to the charm, too. I whirl around, trying to get the attention of whoever is watching. It is clear to me that the creature, though wounded, will live. Left to their own devices, the Mogs will nurse their beast back to health so it can live to spoil another day. I stride over to it, remembering the rabbit I killed all those years ago in Nova Scotia. I hear the footsteps of approaching guards and know I must act fast. A Moog guard bursts into the room. He wields a long blade and is about to swing at me when he thinks twice, realizing he will only kill himself in the process. I use his hesitation to my advantage. I leap off the ground and hit him with a high swing kick, his blade clattering to the floor. One more kick to keep him down, and then I swipe the blade from the floor. I approach the heaving, panting beast as more guards enter the room, and I bring the blade straight down, through the Piken's skull. Dead in an instant. The guards swarm around me and drag me out of the cell. I am dazed, but happy. No mercy. Chapter 16. I have come to appreciate the tiny differences in the food they serve me. It's always the same gray slop, some protein and wheat blended into a paste and ladled onto my serving tray. But sometimes it is made with more water and less wheat, more wheat and less protein, etc. Today is a heavy protein day. I swallow it down without joy, but with some gratitude. My muscles still hurt from my battle with the Piken and the guard, and I figure the protein will do me good. I take my last bite and back into the corner. It is dark in my cell, but there is just enough light from the food slot that I can see my feet and my hands and my food tray. Except today, I can't see my hand. I can see my left one, but not my right one. It has taken a long time to hone my vision to this state of sensitivity in the dark, so I'm furious at its failure. I wave my right hand in front of my face, twisting it left and right in my sleeve, but still all I see is darkness. I slap my face, blink, trying to bring my vision back. But still my right hand is a void. Finally, I reach down and pick up my fork, holding it in front of my face. I feel a thrill in my stomach as I push it down into my hand. I don't want any false hope. I know I can't survive any false hope. But I can see the fork. And I still can't see my hand. At that moment, my cell door opens and a lowly Moog enters. He's come to retrieve my serving tray. All it takes is the light from the hallway flooding the room to confirm my suspicion. My right hand is invisible. My first legacy has arrived. I gasp. Of all the skills I could develop, this seems like the one, the only one, that might get me out of this prison alive. The Moog grunts at me suspiciously, and I tuck my hollow-looking sleeve behind my back, hoping he didn't see. I am dizzy with joy. He's a stupid one, and doesn't notice a thing. He lifts my tray from the floor and exits the room. I am plunged back into darkness and wait impatiently for my eyes to adjust to the point where I can see my new ability again. There it is. Hollow sleeve. Invisible hand. I roll up my sleeve and look at my arm. My hand is completely invisible. My forearm, milky, nearly translucent. But by my elbow, I'm fully visible. I can see I'll need to practice this skill. Chapter 17. It has taken 2 days, but I have learned to wield my first legacy. My control is not perfect yet. Sometimes my invisibility stutters, and I panic, struggling to restore it. Turning it off and on is not like turning a light switch up or down. It takes a certain kind of concentration. Katerina's breathing exercises have come in handy. When I struggle to control my invisibility, I turn my focus to my breathing. In, out, and then back to the ability. After I'm able to make my hand invisible at will, I start practicing with other parts of my body. It's like flexing a new muscle. It feels strange at first, but quickly feels natural. Next, I let my whole body fade out. It's no more difficult than making my hand disappear. In fact, it seems to take less precision. I am ready. I go fully invisible and wait for the next food drop. It takes some of my energy to maintain the invisibility, energy I wish I could conserve, but I have only that single instant for my snare to work, and I can't risk them seeing me transform. Finally, a Moog appears. The food slot opens. The tray is tossed in. It shuts. I worry the snare hasn't worked. Maybe the Moogs don't bother to check on me, to look for me in my cell, in which case my power is totally useless. The slot opens again. 2 beady eyes peer into the shadows, squinting. In, out. Sometimes nerves can send me back into visibility, and I can't spoil this moment. In, out. The worst-case scenario is them discovering my power before I can use it against them. It is a strange thing, willing someone to see my absence. The slot closes again. I hear the Moog walk away and my heart plummets. Where'd he go? Didn't he notice that I'm not here? The door opens suddenly. Soon my tiny cell is filled with Moogadorian guards, 4 in total. I press myself against the far corner, hiding. They are huddled close, conferring about my apparent disappearance. No way out. 1 leaves and runs down the hall. His exit creates more space in the room, less chance that someone will stumble onto me, and I breathe easier. 1 of them whirls his arm in frustration, and I have to duck as quickly as I can. He barely misses me. Close call. I dodge, quiet as a cat, into the corner nearest the door. 2 of the Moogs stand deep in the cell, but 1 of them blocks the exit. Move, I think. Move! I can hear footsteps racing towards the cell. More Moogs. I know that all it will take is 1 Moog brushing my shoulder or sensing my breath for me and my new legacy to be discovered. The footsteps are getting closer. The Moog by the door steps further into the cell to accommodate those on their way, and I lunge out into the hallway. I nearly fall on the stone floor outside my cell, but I catch my balance just in time. Flesh slapping against stone, I surely would have been discovered. A horde of Moogs is racing down the hall towards my cell from the left. No choice but to run right. I take off, landing as delicately as I can, quiet as a cat. It is a long haul. I struggle to maintain quiet, my bare feet making only the faintest of noises as I run and run and run. At first I am scared, but then I can feel it. Freedom up ahead. I go faster, landing on arched feet to mute the noise. My heart leaps up into my chest as I exit the hall and find myself in the center of the Mogadorian complex, a massive cavern fed by many other tunnels like the one I just came from. Closed-circuit security cameras are everywhere. When I spot them, my chest leaps with fear. But then I remember I am invisible, to cameras as well as to Moogs. For how long, I don't know. A siren is pulled. I should have expected that. Flashing security lights go off as the cavern is filled with the alarm's shriek. The high walls of the cave only amplify it. I take off again, choosing a tunnel at random. I pass other cells like mine, then steel doors that probably hold more prisoners. I wish I had time to help them, but all I can do is run and keep running as long as my invisibility will hold. I dodge left off the tunnel, passing a large, glass-windowed room to my right. It is illuminated by bright fluorescence. Inside, hundreds and hundreds of computers in rows hum and sift data, no doubt looking for signs of my fellow guard. I keep running. I pass another laboratory, also glass-windowed, this one to my left. Mogadorians in white plastic suits and goggles stand inside. Scientists? Bomb chemists? I am past them before I have a chance to see what they're doing. I can only assume something awful. My brain is split by the siren, and I want to close my ears. But I need my hands to keep my balance as I run, to keep my footsteps dainty and soundless. I have the strange thought that for all my bluntness, my tomboyishness, my warrior's training, I now find myself calling on such a feminine skill, being light-footed, like a ballerina. The tunnel feeds into another center, this one even larger than the other. I had assumed that what I saw earlier was the heart of the complex, but this is truly it. A cavernous hall, half a mile wide, and so dark and murky I can barely see across to the other side. I am covered in sweat, out of breath. It is hot in here. The walls and ceiling are lined with huge wooden trellises keeping the cave from collapsing in on itself. Narrow ledges, chiseled into the rock face, connect the tunnels dotting the dark walls. Above me, several long arches have been carved from the mountain itself to bridge the divide from one side to the other. I catch my breath and wipe my brow to keep my own sweat from blinding me. There are so many tunnels, none of them marked. My heart plummets. I realize I could run and run through this complex for days without finding the way out. I imagine myself like a rat in a laboratory maze, scampering and weaving to no avail. Then I see it. A single pinprick of natural light up above. There must be a way out up there. It will be a steep climb up these walls, but I can do it. As I grab the trellis to hoist myself up, I hear it. She will be found. It's him, Katarina's executioner. He is speaking to a few guard Moogs on a walkway above me. The guards tramp off. My eyes pin to the executioner as he takes a detour back into the complex. I must choose between escape and vengeance. The light above beckons me like water in a desert. I wonder exactly how long it's been since I last saw sunlight. But I turn around. I choose
Vengeance.
Chapter 18. I follow him through the halls on tiptoe, careful to maintain my invisibility. I've learned enough about my legacy by now to know that any surprise or break in concentration can cause me to fade back in. I watch as he ducks into a cell. I sneak in behind him as the door shuts. Unaware he has company, he walks to the corner of the room and begins to tidy up. I look down. There is blood on the floor. His weapons are out. He has tortured and killed others. I have never killed a Mogadorian before. Not counting the Mogadorians who died trying to kill me, I have only in my entire life killed a rabbit and a piken. To my own shock, I realize I am thirsty for murder. I grab a razor from his desk and approach him. The blade feels good in my hand. It feels right. I know better than to give him a chance to beg or plead, to shake me from my resolve. I clutch him from behind and slit his throat with one clean slice. His mouth gurgles and spews blood across the floor, against my hands. He falls to his knees and then bursts into ash. I feel more alive than I've ever felt. I open my mouth to speak. "That's for Katerina," I'm about to say. But I don't. I don't speak because I know it's a lie. That wasn't for Katerina. That was for me. I emerge from the complex an hour later, exhausted and struggling to stay invisible as I climb out to the mountaintop, as I run from the mountains to a hill opposite. I have to stop to rest, to adapt to the blinding midday sun. My translucent skin bakes beneath the sun. I stare at the mouth of the complex, already hard to make out from this distance. I don't trust my memory, so I pause to memorize its shape, its precise location. I am sure Moogs have fanned out through the complex looking for me, and I'm sure they have crawled out of the exit and are even right now searching through the trees along these hills. Let them look. They'll never find me. I run for a few miles through trees until I come to a road in a small mining town. I'm running barefoot, so the road slaps hard against my feet, killing my joints. I don't care. I'll get a pair of sneakers eventually. I find a truck idling at the town's only stoplight. I lightly hop into the back of the pickup, letting the truck take me farther and farther away from the Mogadorian complex. When the trucker stops for gas a few hours later, I dash, still invisible, into the cab, rifling through his stuff. I take a handful of quarters, a pen, a couple scraps of paper, and an uneaten bag of barbecue chips. I run behind the gas station and sit in the shade. I draw a map of the complex's entrance on one side of the paper and a diagram of the tunnels inside as best as I can remember. It will be a long time before I put this to use, but I know my memory of their hideaway is the most valuable thing I possess, and it must be preserved. Once I finish the diagram, I throw my head back. It's sunset, but I can still feel the warmth of the sun on my face. I open the bag of chips and eat them in three messy bites. The salty, sweet chips taste delicious. Wonderful. I am in a motel room at long last. For a full day, I wandered, driven by the urge for shelter and rest. There was no way I could afford a room, and in my desperation, I began to consider thievery. Pick a few pockets, plunk down the cash I'd need. Using my legacy, stealing would be a piece of cake. But then it occurred to me I wouldn't need to steal. Not yet, anyway. Instead, I went into the lobby of a small motel, went invisible, and snuck into the hotel manager's office. I lifted the key for room 21 off the hook. I wasn't sure how I was going to get the floating key past the crowded lobby, and I paused for a moment, frozen in the office. But soon, the key disappeared too, in my palm. I'd never made an object disappear before, only myself and my clothes. A hint of my legacy's other uses. I've been in the room for a couple hours, so I feel less like I'm thieving. I sleep above the covers, in the chill of the room's AC. I catch myself. I've been invisible the whole time I've been in the room, clenched from the exertion of sustaining it. It's like holding your breath. I get up and approach the mirror across the room, letting it go. My body fills in the mirror, and I see my face for the first time in over 7 months. I gasp. The girl who stares back at me is almost unrecognizable. I'm hardly even a girl anymore. I stare at myself for a long time, standing alone in the room, unattended, unaccompanied, aching for Katerina, aching for a worthy tribute to her. But it's right there, in the new hardness and definition of my face, in the muscled curve of my arm. I am a woman now, and I am a warrior. Her love and the loss of her is etched forever in the firm set of my jaw. I am her tribute. Survival is my gift to her. Satisfied, I return to the motel bed and sleep for days.